Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this incredibly important phone call. As you know, last week, Israelis went to the polls, and there are two parties that are in contention for who will take the premiership. As most of you on this call know, the Blue and White Party, which appears to have emerged as the winner in a very close race, which is headed by retired General Benny Gantz, followed closely by the Likud Party, as you know, which is headed by Prime Minister Netanyahu with 31 seats and Benny Gantz with 33. So now the horse trading has begun. As you know, the Knesset has 120 seats, and whosoever party can either get 61 seats on their own or manage to form a coalition with smaller parties, and thereby getting to 61, emerges as the winner. And it is up to the president of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin, to give the responsibility of forming a coalition to the party with the greatest percentage of votes, or the one that can manage to form a coalition with the smaller parties. So the horse trading has begun, and there is nobody who is more qualified to be able to talk about this than Alex Trayman, who is the Jerusalem bureau chief and the managing director of the Jewish News Syndicate, which is a phenomenal paper, news service. Alex is a veteran Israeli journalist and is a consultant for the fabulous Israeli startup companies, and he has also directed and produced a number of incredible award-winning documentaries such as Iranium and Honor Diaries, which Ahmet has had the honor of showing on Capitol Hill. So without further ado, I want to take it the floor over to Alex Trayman, who is a gifted writer, an astute political analyst, and a phenomenal young man and a good friend. Alex?
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. And before we get started with the elections, I think it is important just to emphasize how much terrific work Ahmet and you, Sarah, and your entire staff have been doing on Capitol Hill, educating about key issues that relate to Israel and the greater Middle East, and doing such a fine job at that for so many years. We really feel the impact of what you're doing, not just over there where you are, but over here in Jerusalem. So just want to wish you continued success in all of your endeavors. So you did correctly indicate that it might appear that the Blue and White defeated the Likud, taking 33 seats to 31 of the Likud. Of course, both of those numbers represent just more than 25% of the total electorate. And in order to rule in Israel, you need to be able to form a majority coalition of at least half of the Knesset, which would be 61, would be a very narrow majority, but that's the bare minimum that's needed to form a government. And so while Blue and White did win 33 seats, they won approximately 30,000 more votes than they could. Their national supporters on the left only give them an additional 11 seats, leaving them at 44 a block of 44 seats to the center left of the Israeli spectrum. Meanwhile, to the right of the Israeli spectrum, 55 Knesset members have recommended Benjamin Netanyahu and their natural partners. Now, there's also two other parties which are worthy of mentioning right now. The first is Avigdor Lieberman's party. Lieberman has sat in right-wing governments for many, many years consecutively. Of course, he resigned his post as the defense minister in November of 2018 over what he called Benjamin Netanyahu's weak reaction to ongoing hostilities from Gaza, overruling his his role as a defense minister, and he wanted to have a much stronger reaction to Gazan hostility. In the April elections, the right wing, including Avigdor Lieberman's party, which took 5 seats in April, totaled 65 seats. And everybody thought after the April election that a new right-wing government would be formed. Of course, Lieberman declined to join the right-wing government at that time, citing differences over a law that would increase the number of Orthodox conscripts to the army. The Orthodox have males that get exemptions from the army as part of a longstanding status quo that's a cause of much consternation among the Israeli public. But he brought that issue up in April, and he left Netanyahu with only 60 seats, which was one short of the narrow majority he would have needed to form a government. That is what caused the new elections. In September, Lieberman received 8 mandates. He's been calling for a national unity government between the two parties, but in the recommendations that just took place over the last 2 days, he did not recommend to Israel's president that either Netanyahu or Benny Gantz be given the first shot at making a government. So he is playing a neutral role right now. And then the other party worth mentioning is the Joint Arab List. That's a a faction of 4 separate parties that ran together in a technical union. 10 of the 13 Knesset members recommended Benny Gantz as the prime minister. It was the first time that they had recommended any candidate for prime minister since the early 90s, when many recommended Yitzhak Rabin in advance of the Oslo Accords. That gives Gantz 54 total recommendations to Netanyahu's 55. However, within those recommendations, first of all, 3 other Arab MKs refused to recommend Gantz. And secondly, all 10 that did recommend Gantz said that they would not sit in a government with Netanyahu or Gantz. So the recommendation, while it was being called historic in the media, is really completely meaningless. Now, what Netanyahu has done is he already signed agreements with the members to his right flank, his natural partners, to form a united bloc of 55 Knesset members that would negotiate any coalition deal together. Meanwhile, Gantz on the left only has 44 natural partners. And since neither one has received the 61 necessary, that puts Israel's president, Ruvi Rivlin, whose responsibility is to task one of the members of the government, one of the Knesset members, with the responsibility of forming government, in a unique place. Usually the president has very little leeway if one Knesset member receives more than 60 recommendations. He will give that Knesset member the opportunity to form a government. Right now, the president has until October 2nd to decide who to task first with the formation of a government. It is believed that he will wait now over the next several days before taking a decision. Once he gives the opportunity to a Knesset member, that first candidate will have 28 days to try to form a coalition government, and they can also request at the end of that a 14-day extension. If he fails to form a government at the end of those 42 days, then the president will turn to the opposition, giving them an opportunity to form a government. They would have 28 days to do so. At the end of that 28-day period, if no Knesset member is able to, if neither the first or the second candidate are able to form a government, any Knesset member can bring a letter to the president, provided that they have a petition of 61 signatures, and then the president would grant that third Knesset member, who could be anybody from the 120, to try to form a government. And if at the end of that period nobody is able to form a government, then the president forms a Knesset, then no one is able to form a government, and a third election would be held. And that actually does remain one of the possible scenarios in light of the election deadlock. So just to summarize what we've said so far, even though Blue and White did take two more seats, Netanyahu's bloc is considerably larger. However, neither of them yet has a majority to form a government, which makes things very complicated. So with that, there are numerous scenarios that could emerge. The president is pushing very hard for there to be a unity government between the Likud and the Blue and White, possibly with Avigdor Lieberman's Israel Beiteinu party, although any party to the right or the left could be part of such a scenario. And the two large parties together would represent 64 mandates. Those two parties by themselves could form a majority government, and then any other party that would join on board would just add more stability. However, it should be noted that in the polarized political environment that we have, that a unity government may not be the most stable government because the two parties are at odds with one another. So if any one of those parties would leave the coalition, that would destroy the government. And then there's the big question of, in a unity alignment, who would lead? Benny Gantz has been pushing for a unity government that is without Benjamin Netanyahu. He's pushing very hard for Netanyahu to leave his position as the chairman of the Likud, claiming that he has suffered electoral defeat. Of course, Netanyahu is really not prepared to hand over the country to anyone, let alone a political opponent to his left. And he not only is demanding to remain, be given the first crack at leading any government, including the unity government, he is also staying true to the agreement that he signed to so far with the other parties to his right, his natural partners, saying that I will only negotiate on behalf of this entire bloc. So Benny Gantz has been calling for a unity government that is a secular government, a government that would be without Netanyahu's natural partners are the religious parties, which are about 17 seats between the two religious parties, plus the right-wing Yamina party, which has another 8 seats. So there's 25 seats, basically, to the right that Netanyahu is lumping into his negotiations together with the Blue and White. Negotiations really just started, actually today, between the delegations of Blue and White and Likud. However, there was already a disagreement where the Likud delegation said, we are negotiating on behalf of all these 55 Knesset members, and the Blue and White delegation said, we want to be clear, we believe we're only negotiating with the Likud. So right now, there's a bit of a stalemate even in the unity talks, but we'll see. We will see where that goes. And I think that's the basis of where we're at, and I will be very, very happy to open the floor up to questions. I mean, we can also talk a little bit later about what's at stake, but let's first take any questions that we might have about the coalition scenarios and where we might be.
Okay, as the moderator, I'd like to have the prerogative of asking the first question, and that is General Benny Gantz had said, after Bibi had said, you know, that he was going to promise to annex the Jordan Valley settlements, he had said, wait a minute, we said that first. Do you think that there will really be implications in terms of the Israeli withdrawal process, if there is a blue and white government in charge as opposed to a Likud government?
Right, it's a question with many facets to it. The first one is to understand that even though Gantz has united with the political left, he's also had some defectors from the political right within his party, and he himself was chief of staff under Netanyahu, and Netanyahu even extended his term by a year as chief of staff, indicating his general appreciation for Gantz's work. So it's not clear that we have this this right versus typical right versus left divide that we used to have. People recognize in Israel that the Oslo process, which was meant to create a Palestinian state on territories which Israel captured from Jordan and from Egypt during the 1967 war, turned out to be an utter failure, and the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in 2005 really served as a test case for what the creation of a Palestinian entity in any of those territories could look like. And as such, Israelis on the left side of the spectrum are not talking about the creation of a Palestinian state on any of those territories right now. In the run-up to the election, Netanyahu did say in a dramatic announcement that should he form the next government, that he would annex the Jordan Valley. And this is the area which is to Israel's easternmost border and also wraps around the northern sections of the Dead Sea and essentially would landlock any Palestinian entity that might be created later on. However, it does provide for Israel's security. And remember that Israel is a very, very narrow piece of land, and moving back from the Jordan Valley could put Israel's population centers of Jerusalem and the Tel Aviv region in very, very serious danger. Remember, only several years ago, you know, rockets were fired at Ben Gurion Airport, you know, the Palestinian-controlled areas are literally just 1 or 2 miles away from Ben Gurion Airport. So having that land to the east is very important. And Benny Gantz did say, look, we also believe that Israel should have the Jordan Valley. However, the question of whether a blue and white-led government would act to quickly change longstanding status quos and take the action of annexing the Jordan Valley, even if it's not ideologically opposed to such a move, is a different question. And that really remains to be seen. We would imagine that Gantz would tread more carefully if he were to form a government, both with the Trump administration and also with Israel's neighbors, until he would get his standing. Netanyahu, who's been in the job for 10 years, feels very, very comfortable right now with the Trump administration and has really been moving issues of sovereignty forward. So I think that you could assume that a right-wing government led by Netanyahu would be more likely to annex the Jordan Valley, but you can't rule out that a Gantz-led government would do the same thing.
Right. I'm going to actually ask you one more question, and then I'm going to hand this over to Sarah Leah Thompson, who's going to read some of the questions that have come in. If you do want to be on the queue and ask further questions, just press star 6 and, you know, identify yourself and you can ask your question. My next question, Alex, is Avigdor Lieberman, you know, has emerged as the kingmaker and deal breaker here, and he only got 8 mandates. Why has he become so powerful, and is it so necessary that he throw his support behind one of the parties before a government could be formed?
Right. Well, Nathan, basically the way the political system works, almost any small party can emerge as a kingmaker in the parliamentary system and the build up to a majority coalition. Obviously, Lieberman, you know, forced the first election more or less with his resignation in November, and then his refusal to join the government that Netanyahu was trying to form in April led essentially to the second election. So he becomes a kingmaker because he leads a notoriously right-wing party. In fact, many would consider on security issues, leave him in positions to be extremely hawkish. So his defection from the right-wing bloc, and I think it is very, very important to establish that with Lieberman, Israel's right wing would have a 63-mandate majority as compared to a 44-mandate bloc, which is on Israel's left wing, and that gives you an indication of where the country is. But his defection from Netanyahu and the right-wing bloc actually turns him into the kingmaker. However, there's only one person, which the math dictates, that Lieberman could crown king. If Lieberman were to have recommended Benny Gantz as the prime minister, and he would support him with his 8 seats, without the Arab parties, that would still only be 52 seats and short of a majority. However, if Lieberman will take his 8 seats back to the right wing, where they sat for many years together, that would, Netanyahu would be able to easily form a government and continue leading a right-wing majority in Israel. And the fact that he did not recommend either Gantz or Netanyahu, I think, leaves open the significant possibility that Lieberman could, in fact, move over back to his natural spot on the right wing. However, a kingmaker could, in fact, demand a king's ransom. So you would have to see Netanyahu be able to make progress with his natural partners that are the religious partners to get them to agree to some of the policy changes that Lieberman is trying to enact with regard to how many religious men are drafted into the military, possibly also with regard to Israeli responses to continued Gazan aggression. And in that way, if Netanyahu is able to extract those types of concessions from his national partners, they have a lot to lose if they are excluded from a government that's a unity government led by either Netanyahu or Gantz. Then you could possibly see the right wing come back together.
Great. Okay, I'm going to now hand the floor over to my colleague, Sarah Leah Thompson, who will read the questions that have come in.
Okay, so our first question, what happens to religious institutions such as the rabbinate if the Orthodox parties sit in the opposition?
That's a great question, and really any government that has a majority in their own parliament could legislate various changes to any one of the numerous status quo issues that are currently governed by the rabbinate and the religious party. So the key issues, as we first mentioned, are the issue of conscription, which is a major, major issue across Israeli society. Basically, all men, except for religious men, need to go serve. So the burden of responsibility is not evenly shared. Of course, that also leads into secondary and but equally important issues with regard to how much money the religious learning institutions receive from the government, which enables religious men to sit and study religious texts in those institutions as opposed to going out into the workforce. So again, there's an unequal distribution of burden with regard to the economy. There are other issues as well. The issues of kashrut, the kosher food certification, the issues of who is allowed to convert into Judaism, who is allowed to marry, burial societies. These are all controlled by the basically religious monopolies, as well as key holy sites, including the Western Wall, which on the one hand are populated and utilized most often by religious Jews that come to pray in what is basically Israel's largest synagogue, the Western Wall Plaza. But, of course, we've heard a lot of discord about the creation of a larger egalitarian section of the Western Wall Plaza, and these are issues that rub up against the religious parties and their sort of political monopolies over these key areas. And yes, you're raising the right question, which is the religious parties have a lot to lose because a government that that Gadsden and Weaver are trying to form, which they call a secular unity government. It is unity between the right and the left, but it's not unity between the secular and religious because it excludes the religious. But such a secular government would probably try to legislate to break some of these monopolies, and there would be very little the religious parties could do about it.
Okay. Thank you so much. So our next question that we've received, are Palestinian Arabs actually the decisive factor in Israeli elections?
No, Palestinian Arabs are not the decisive factor in Israeli elections, although they do take a certain percentage out of the map. Basically, there was 13 votes for the Israeli Arab parties. There's three more than in April, but not too much more historically than they've received in the past. Every Israeli government from the creation of the state until today has been formed without the Arab parties being a part. What was very interesting, a few things to note again, is that the Arab parties, while they recommended Gantz, they will not sit with Gantz, even if he forms a government. And Lieberman said that he would not sit together with Gantz should Gantz go into government with the Arab parties. He said not even in a parallel universe. And he indicated that that the Palestinian parties actually represent an enemy of Israel. What's interesting was a Konrad Adenauer poll that came out about 2 weeks before the elections, where they asked who people thought was the most best suited to be prime minister. And the one who won that poll with 25% of the Arab vote was Netanyahu. And the second with less than 10% was Ayman Odeh, who's the head of the joint Arab parties. And Benny Gantz, who received the recommendation, got only 9.6% support as the best suited to be prime minister from the Arab parties. So from the Arab public. So you can see that there's a bit of a discord between what the Arab populations that are citizens of Israel may have chosen and what the political representation of the Arabs that sits in the Knesset, what they push for. And, if you go into the office of Ahmed Tibi, you will see a picture of Ahmed Tibi standing with Yasser Arafat in the op-ed that Ayman Odeh submitted to the New York Times in announcing that he would recommend Benny Gantz for the prime minister while also saying that he wouldn't join his government. He noted that he was representing people with a Palestinian national identity, which implies that he does not consider himself to have an Israeli national identity, even though he serves in Israel's parliament. So there's definitely some serious questions that can be raised about the intentions of those that actually serve the Arab communities within Israel's parliament. Are they really acting within the best interests of their own constituents, or are they trying to just infiltrate what is otherwise a Jewish parliament?
Thank you. Our next question is a little bit of a long one, so bear with me. How can they be considering a unity government? Wouldn't that give a Muslim party, which is currently the third largest party in Israel, the status of, quote, opposition party, unquote? And as the opposition party, wouldn't they receive briefings involving national security, bodyguards, etc.?
Yes, absolutely. That is correct. That if the entire blue and white party and the entire Likud party together enter into a unity alignment and no other parties combine to become larger. As it stands right now, the Joint Arab List is the third largest party in the Knesset, although be it only with 13 seats. And yes, they would in that type of alignment become the opposition leaders. And the opposition leader does, in fact, receive security briefings by law. So it's certainly an issue that needs to be considered. It should also be pointed out that the Joint Arab List is a technical union of four very small parties that even among themselves don't always get along. So it's it's an issue. But there could be, I think that there could potentially be alignments, let's say, that the two religious parties to the right, if they were excluded from a unity government, could say, we're merging into a singular party right now, and then that would make them larger than the Arab party. So there might be courses of action to prevent such a scenario from taking place.
Okay, thank you. We have another longer question. King Abdullah II has announced that there will be a major impact on the relationship that Israel has with Jordan and Egypt if Israel declares sovereignty over Judea and Samaria. Certainly, the king has to make such a statement for domestic consumption because his populace is virulently anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. What do you surmise that King Abdullah II and President al-Sisi will do, if anything, in response to this action by Israel?
Well, first of all, I don't think that Israel will apply any sovereignty without the explicit permission of the United States right now, and within the framework of whatever the peace plan that the Trump administration is planning on revealing within the coming weeks after the formation of a new government, which could be a long time from now. And if you understand that this plan is also meant to be a regional plan, you could imagine that there are significant incentives for Jordan and for Egypt financially as part of the plan. However, as you mentioned correctly in the question, you know, the statements that are made for domestic consumption when the political reality is that King Abdullah is completely reliant not only on the Israeli government but also on the United States for support in order to continue ruling his country. And so while on the one hand he needs to talk a tough game so as not to be overthrown from parties within, if he would take any kind of steps to damage the security ties that currently exist between Israel and Jordan, that could come at Jordan's expense as well.
Thank you. Okay, we have one more question that was sent in advance. Religious parties historically never cared who is elected as long as their narrow issues are addressed. Is there a chance that the religious parties can join a liberal and blue and white coalition to create a 61 vote majority?
Historically, religious parties have joined governments with the left, although it hasn't happened in a long time, in part because the right wing has been ruling the country for the last 30 of the last 42 years. But what's happened over time is that the key issues are shifting. The political divide between right and left used to be over the Land for Peace formula, and the left pushing more towards the creation of a Palestinian state in Judea and Samaria, the right wing wanting to retain Judea and Samaria. But today, the right and left have become much closer on that issue, and the divide is shifting more towards issues of social religious that we mentioned before in one of the previous questions, where you have Yair Lapid, whose Yesh Atid party is one of the major factions of the Blue and White Alliance. The Blue and White is actually an alliance of three parties that came together. Benny Gantz's Resilience Party, Yair Lapid's Yesh Atid Party, and Bogi Yalon, Moshe Yalon's Telem Party. And they all came together with the sole purpose of trying to defeat Netanyahu. As part of the agreement that Blue and White made between the parties, Benny Gantz would be the prime minister for the first 2 years, and after 2.5 years, rather, Yair Lapid would become the prime minister should Blue and White be able to form a government on its own without any kind of other rotation agreement with another party. So you have Yair Lapid, who is a prime minister in waiting, and Yair Lapid has been promoting very strongly against the ultra-Orthodox parties. He put out some cartoon during the election campaign showing the religious parties as money grubbing, and there was all kind of claims of anti-Semitism going on. And also, Avigdor Lieberman is calling for a secular government that would exclude the religious parties. So it makes it very difficult with all the bad blood for those parties then to turn around and to sit with the same people that are specifically campaigning against them. However, if things develop over time and it becomes clear that Benjamin Netanyahu cannot form a government, I think that you could expect any party on the right of the spectrum, be it the religious party, be it the nationalist party, or even a faction of the Likud, from moving over and crossing to the left in order to be part of a government, because there's going to be a choice. It's either be part or be excluded. So really anything is possible, and at the same time you could see the same thing where a faction that right now is aligned with Benny Gantz could move over and join a Netanyahu-led government, including a faction of the blue and white itself. Just like as I mentioned, there are three parties there, and it's possible that they may split as well as things develop. So really there's a lot of unknown here.
Okay, Alex, I have a couple of more questions. The first question, as Sarah, the first question is, I don't know if it's still true because things are changing minute by minute, but a couple of days ago, Benny Gantz said he would never be able to form a unity government as long as Prime Minister Netanyahu leads the Likud. Is there any heir apparent in the Likud party, and has Prime Minister Netanyahu shown any kind of willingness to pass the torch to someone else?
One of the major criticisms against Netanyahu over the years is that he has not been grooming an heir apparent to his position. And not only has he been grooming a successor, but everyone that sort of quickly rises up the ranks of the Likud party, he ships off. And a key example of that is Danny Dandone, who was a rising star in the Likud, who then was sort of jettisoned to become the ambassador of the United Nations, which on the one hand is a high-profile post, on the other hand is very far from the action in Jerusalem. Recently, a few weeks back, Netanyahu was asked who he could see leading the country in the years after his premiership ended, and he said there's two people that he could see being as capable of running the country. The first is Yossi Cohen, who is the director of the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency. The second was Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador to the United States, and Dermer served as a senior advisor to Netanyahu before receiving the ambassadorship in Washington. But within the Likud party itself, if Netanyahu was unable to form a government, there would be tremendous jockeying with inside the party to see who would emerge. Some of the leading candidates for that would be Knesset Speaker Yuli Edelstein, Yisrael Katz, who's currently the foreign minister, Gideon Saar, who used to be minister of communications, I believe, and then left politics and now came back. Also Gilad Erdan, who's the minister of strategic affairs. So there are a few potential candidates, but no clear heir apparent within the party.
Okay. And my final question to you, Alex, is, it is true that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump enjoy very, very close personal relations. But we here are facing an election in the United States, and eventually there will be, maybe not this time around, but eventually we are going to have a Democratic president. Would you concede that others have argued to me, and would you concede that it might actually be good for Israel if there was a change in premiership, if there were a Democratic White House that came into office in 2020? And I know that, that this is a very, very unique relationship, and I'm very grateful to both President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. However, internationally, Bibi is not, except for in a few cases, like in India, he's not particularly well-loved, and certainly not in the international media. Do you think it might give Israel a bit of a honeymoon period if the premiership were to go to blue and white as opposed to liquid?
I don't think that you could call it a honeymoon period. While Netanyahu is not necessarily well-liked either within the Democratic Party or in the United States or within most of Western Europe, even within those places, he is well-respected. People understand that they cannot push him around. I think that also he's not prone to major diplomatic missteps, and who knows what an alignment that's led by Benny Gantz, which doesn't really have, it has experienced military men, but not experienced diplomats, what kind of missteps that they could take. And I think that the current alignment between Trump and Netanyahu, while not popular around the world, is very popular in Israel. Israelis really do appreciate Donald Trump more than other countries do. Israelis also never really took to Barack Obama, even though he was beloved in Europe and other places. But the alignment between Trump and Netanyahu has created tremendous gains for Israel, including the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the declaration of sovereignty in the Golan, the reestablishment of the U.S. veto against anti-Israel resolutions at the United Nations, and, of course, the pullout of the Iran deal. And I think that anybody could understand that if a Democratic president were to emerge in the United States, that they may try to, I would say, walk back or re-enter some kind of negotiation or deal with Iran, which could put Israeli security at significant existential risk.
Thank you so much, Alex. We are really honored to have friends such as you, you know, who are really fighting the good fight. They're, you know, putting your life on the line. You're an American who has made Aliyah and putting your family's lives on the line for all of us there in Israel, which we at Amit consider on the front lines of the war between Western civilization and radical Islam. We believe very strongly that we have got to tell the truth, and it is only because we have phenomenal friends such as you, Alex Trayman, who are great emissaries of the truth out of Zion, that we are able to do this. And I'd also like to let people know that we are a 501c3, and we do depend on contributions in order to survive. We get no money from any federal grants, from any governments. And, you know, in order for us to keep our doors open, it is almost Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and it's time for people to think of a little tzedakah, a little charity. Please think of us when you do your giving. We do have to keep our lights on. We have salaries to pay and rents to pay, and programs such as these to continue to offer to the public. All of this is a free service for the public at large, and we have some members of Congress that have called in today as well. And we are very, very honored and privileged to be able to do this work, but we would, you know, really need your continued contributions in order for us to continue. Anyway, and again, thank you so much, Alex. You truly are a light into the nations. Okay, and this concludes our program.
That people can continue to follow us at JNS.org. And if you have any questions, you could send me an email, atrayman@JNS.org. I'll be happy to answer any other questions you guys might have.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Thanks. Bye.
Shana Tova.